everything, everything, everything is up for challenge.
True.
Even notions of life and death.
Yep.
Even notions of life and death are up for challenge. Mm-hmm. So we here in this room at this time, in this moment we call the 21st century, we have an opportunity to really contribute to that future, which is the next breath. And as I think Kara said in her introduction, the best stories are your stories. And so my story has to do with living as a woman in her 60s who has a sexual life, who has an erotic life, who wants to explore that and doesn't want to live in some way that the politics of respectability, for example, don't allow that. You know, I want to...
Have you always been so free in your writing in terms of not being constrained by the respectability of how black women are supposed to not be as sexual because we're so utterly sexualized within culture? Because I know from, I'll just talk from my own experience.
Why don't you answer?
And maybe
that?
It's because maybe I'm not at that point in my life where I've completely taken off those chains of respectability. Right, and that's something that I'm still challenging myself constantly. It's like I remember, like, even writing about this, you know, the my experiences in the sex trade and sex work, and hearing people as I'm writing, right? You hear that voice saying, "Why are you writing about that?" People are going to think, "How are you a whatever the labels that they've thrown on you, a role model, a representative?" How are you writing about? You know, how dare you write about that? How dare you not fit into the way that we want you to be? But this is my truth, and I say, I just always side with truth.
Yeah.
But I'm still, that voice is still there telling me that you're not supposed to write about this. And it's because of this, it's linked to the body and expressing the body.
Yeah.
And I think you wrote something, what did you wrote? About past and history. The past has a way of hiding itself in the present, and so does the future. And I thought about, like, the imprints of what has happened to us, what we've made happen, and how it shows on the body and on the mind and the spirit and the way in which we even write about ourselves.
Well, you know, I didn't always know this about myself. One of the joys of being a black woman who is living vibrantly in her 60s is that it's more important for me to tell my truth about me than it is to live everybody else's truth about me. Like, I'm less concerned with other people's notions of my blackness than I am concerned with my own. And there's one of the great things about aging is that you do become, you should. You know, if you're kind of paying attention to your life, you can become a better human being. You really can become a better human being, and you can become a more truthful human being. You can, you know, understand things about yourself that maybe you didn't understand before, and accept things about yourself that maybe you didn't understand and accept before. And I'm thankful that I've, you know, been granted anything called longevity, because now I can really talk about sex. You know, I couldn't used to talk about it because I was kind of locked into these narratives around what is correct for black women to think about, or you know, how, you know, you couldn't talk about how you want to have it, how you like it. You know, we were not granted that space. And we'll never be granted that space unless we take it. So, you know, if I wanted to be crass, I would say, you know what, I really don't give a fuck. But I don't say that lightly. I say that because life has shown me that it's okay for me to be me.
Yes.
It's okay for me to define what blackness is. It's okay for me to define what queer is.
Yes.
It's okay for me to define what sexual is. And it's okay for me to live those narratives out. So it's not that I was always this way, because I wasn't, but I'm thankful that I've lived in such a way. I've had people around me, including my students, who did not let me, you know, just take the easiest road, who were very clear. And I used to tell my students that I'm not learning, this is over. Because if you think I'm here to just teach you, that's not what's happening. I'm here to learn too. So recognizing that the lessons of life and how we become who we are have as much to do with who you are surrounded by and how that, you know, creates your liberation is powerful. Like in your work, you talk a lot about how you were able to glean from other Black feminist writers what you needed to construct your own girlhood and construct your own womanhood. And I think that's really powerful if you would talk about that, because I think people need to hear how you journeyed through that, both as an intellectual space, as a way of theorizing your selfhood, your own body, and also as a way in which you then move out into the world.
Well, think about those threads that kind of exist,
yeah.
Right? And you talk so much about it in Yavo, where it's these simultaneous realities and histories and presence are existing. And I know that once I kind of first got introduced to really reading, not so much reading in the sense of a teacher gives you a book, but going and seeking the books that I want to read and having the agency to say, I choose to read this.
Yeah.
And the books that I was choosing, I remember one of the first books that I chose to read was Waiting to Exhale, which I snuck in because I really wanted to know what grown women were doing, what grown Black women were doing. What did that look like? You know, what were their sexual realities? What were the dramas? What were the gossip? All of that stuff, like, I wanted to know what that was. And then, you know, of course, The Color Purple and... I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and those spoke to me in different ways, and seeing myself on the page. And what I've always known is that you don't have to completely create the mold, like, you can build upon what has already been built, right? And so, like, the really powerful saying that we stand on the shoulders of giants,
yes.
Right? And so, like, going back and seeking, right? And that's why something like this research center is important, right? It's like the idea of there are archives of our history. There are, for me, there were Black women who were told that they didn't belong, say whatever, in the burgeoning gay and lesbian movement, that they didn't belong in the Black liberation movement, that they didn't belong in the feminist movement. And so what they did was write and create themselves. They created the kitchen, you know, Kitchen Table Woman of Color Press, right? They sat and created their own works to say that we deserve to be centered. And so with that, them just existing and doing that, not necessarily probably for me, but what it did for me was that I saw myself and I had a model to then go and then create for myself, right? I had words, I had stories, I had narratives, I had experiences. And so being able to do that, but the mold was already there. And so for me, thinking about how Yavo did this as well, was that it kind of gave you jumping off points of interest in certain things, like the history of New York, the slave ship that was there, bits about Jamaica, all those strains, you can then go and deep dive. And so for me, what was important was that I gave those drops and nuggets of wisdom and knowledge from Black women writers that influenced me deeply, so that you can then go and engage, because that's who taught me.
So do you configure yourself within the community of Black feminist writers? And is that a presentation that you make when you go to campuses and when you do speaking events such as this one?
Oh, completely.
Mm-hmm.
Without Black feminism, I don't think that I...
Does anyone ever say to you, well, how do you get to claim that?
No, I've had people come and... I think in the idea of right now what we're having, this heightened visibility around transness.
Yeah.
I've had people come in around the ideas of trans women taking up space within feminist movements, but then that's largely around like white trans women taking up space within white feminist movements. There's so many deeper, I think the linking of blackness is always, I think I've always identified as black first before everything else. And it seems weird because I hate even doing that.
Right.
But this idea of having to negotiate what parts of myself weigh more than others. But the first thing I learned about myself was that I was a black child. The first thing I learned that I was poor, then black.
That's right.
Right? So like that was very clear. And then on top of all of that, it was like, oh shit, I'm trans. You know what I mean? So, but all of that, you know, created how I experience the world, and so none of it can be separated from each other. But I just don't think that within black feminist spaces there is enough time and resources to think about how trans women belong here. And I think trans women have always been outside of, black trans women of color, poor trans women, have always been outside of any kind of centering in any space. So we've always made our own do and made our own way. And so for me, the way that I learned largely about the world and my own ideas of self was through black women's text. And also the black women in my life, my Grandma Shelley, my Auntie Linda Gale, my Auntie Wee Wee, like that's how I came to self. So I feel like no one can try to police me outside of that space because that is who I am, that is my family, that's me. But you talked about taking up space a little earlier, and I think about the time period that we are in. We were talking about Beyonce, so I feel like we might as well just go there.
Are you ready? You need to get information.
But the idea of a pushback against her taking up space and being not subversive, being overt about her Southern blackness, right? Because I think that we can't separate that, how she sees her blackness, right? Like that it's part of being Southern too, what people are also reacting to. It's a blackness that a lot of white folk are uncomfortable with. And I would say even some black folk are uncomfortable with, right? We don't want to see that kind of Red Lobster hot sauce. Like that's not what, you know what I mean? We don't want that kind of, that's not what we want you to promote to the world. Right, and so this idea of taking up space for her. What was your reaction to seeing Formation?
You know, to be honest, I loved it. I kept watching it over and over and over. I was so happy. And I was happy. I mean, I listened to the, you know, that was going on and all this, you know, what's correct and what's black and blah, blah, blah. But I was happy, one, because the video particularly has a deeply queer sensibility. And I was like, yes! You know, yes, Ms. B. Just call me, baby. Just call me. And so I was really happy about that, in a deeply intellectual way, but also in a deeply visceral way. Also, I think that we've moved beyond the time when we should be policing black women's sexuality.
Right.
And so, you know, for me, the people who were like, you know, going on about she was doing this and she was doing that, I was like, you know, why do you have that expectation of her? Why do you, well, she's a capitalist. Yes. Yeah. We live in a capitalist society. Ooh. How many of us aren't capitalists? Maybe Bernie Sanders, but I mean, you know, so this kind of unreal expectations of her not to kind of communicate her own, as you pointed out, so, you know, so acutely, so keenly, her Southern roots, her own sense of herself as making paper, as like making it possible for some dude to get paper. She's like, yeah, I can make it for you too. You know, so this idea that she has moved out of this space that we can control. We cannot control this woman. And we should get with that. We should be okay. We can't control her. And then sort of look at what it is that she is doing that is valuable for us. How is she making it possible for us to think about everyday black women in the ways that they want to think about themselves and the ways that they want to image themselves and the ways in which they are imaged and we're not looking. We don't see them big boobs, you know what I'm saying? We don't see it. We don't want to see it. You know, we don't want to see how fly this thing is when she gets out of her house. And she got on her raggedy jeans and her, you know, Converse sneakers, and this thing is fly. And we don't want to pay our tribute to those aesthetics.
True.
And so when you look at Beyoncé and all the different looks that she has, most of them are classic black female looks that come directly out of the South. It comes out of the South. So I think that one of the major lessons of her work is that, you know what, I really don't give a fuck. You know, it's that, you know, I've moved to a place that, you know, I can't be brought down. I can't be brought down by black people. White people can try to bring me down. I can't be brought down by straight people. This is me, you know, throw down by a man. So I'm comfortable with her. I mean, it's, you know, as long as she doesn't say something that's hard for me to swallow.
Right.
You know, I'm essentially comfortable with her as a pop figure.
What's so interesting for me in this whole, I think that, you know, her last album was largely around, you know, angered people around her sexual presentation.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say sex, because she's always, ever since she was like 15, she's always been sexy, right? Like even when she was a girl child, existing in this girl group, right? Destiny's Child. But she was sexual, and that angered people, right? With the self-titled album. This one, I think, is uniquely because of her blackness. For some reason, people ignored when she was, you know, wearing Tina Knowles originals for years, right? That she was, you know, that her first major music video, Bills, 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 was in her mother's Houston, Texas salon, and that she was waving around a hot comb and doing black women's hair. Like, she's always been black, right? But for some reason, this particular stance now, when she comes to the point of what people would say, you know, the... Who is it? Paul Mounier, I think, talk about, you know, his warning to pop stars and movie stars is always stay black, you know, because Hollywood will get you, right, and make you convince you to be like, you know, you go further away, and she did the opposite. It's like once she got her cultural currency, she was able to even go further. Like her biggest political statement has been, don't forget, right, and that fear, that presents a sense of fear to people. And when I say people, I mean white people who are afraid that our culture now is finally beginning to represent more diversity, right? More of what we actually look like in the world.
Right.
Right, closer to the realness of who we are.
Right. And also, it's the context in which she comes out of this time. Let's get real. Obama has been president for 7.5 years. That's a long time in this country for someone who identifies as a person of color to be in charge. So that's the larger reality around race. Then there is this, you know, too many people think, oh, this is new, but this whole thing about the popo killing us, that's not news. For most of us, that is not news. That's been going on since 16-whatever. You know what I'm saying? So there is a 300-odd-year history to get us to hashtag Black Lives Matter. So it's the larger context in which also blackness is asserting itself, that we have this woman who's making all this paper, what we call twerking, what they call twerking, we know is bounce. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Just moving that booty all over. I mean, the whole word bootylicious came about because she got a ass like she got ass like. So it's the assertion of that black female body. It's the assertion of blackness at this time. You know, I don't know if you watch Larry Wilmore on TV, comes on the nightly show. He has a segment that's called The Unblackening, where he talks about how, you know, white people want to, you know, erase the history of the White House over the last 7.5 years because it's been too black. This is the moment that we're in. We're in this moment in which we're not really talking enough about, let me put it this way. I was listening to Hillary Clinton this morning. She was in Harlem. She was talking about how she's going to fix black America. She's going to get us more jobs. She's going to, you know, create, you know, racial equality. She's going to, you know, make sure we have housing. And, you know, my first reaction was, you know, what if that discourse, what if that narrative shifted so that it wasn't about fixing us? It's about fixing y'all. With all due respect to anyone in the room who identifies as white or European, with all due respect, the expressions of blackness that we see in people like Barack Obama and Beyonce and Janet Mock and Alexis DeVoe and Kara Ullage and many of you in here whose names I don't know, exist in a particular context. And it exists not in the context of our mere survival, but it exists in the context of our living.
Right.
That's what's really chafing at the bit for a lot of white people. They cannot figure out how we still living. They cannot figure out how we still living. So our living is not the issue. The issue is the redistribution of everything that you have.
Right.
Not what I don't have. It's everything that you have. If what you had was spread more across the earth, my life would be great. You know what I'm saying? It'd be cool because I wouldn't be worried about, do I have housing? Do I have, you know, schools? Do I have jobs? You know, can I leave the house and the popo are waiting to, you know, snatch my breath away? It's not my life. It's not my blackness, it's not Beyonce's blackness, it's not your blackness. That's really the conversation. The conversation is really around white supremacy. Yeah. How is that still functioning?
She just dropped the mic, so let's take some questions.